Yeah, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I've been thinking about these problems for a long time, so it's kind of really nice to hear and learn from other people about them. And in some ways, you know, lower order dispersion sounds like it ought to be, and pulse equations sounds like they ought to be easy, but I think in some respects they're actually more subtle than higher order dispersive equations like KdV. So here's an outline of my talk. I'll get through probably 1 through 3, even in a non-Canadian hour, I wouldn't get through the rest. But I would just want to make a few general remarks about lower order dispersive equations, and then I want to talk about a particular class of equations, in particular a Burgers-Hilbert equation, and explain their connection with constant frequency waves, and then some physical applications if I have any time. But so first, talk about lower order dispersion. So the sort of typical model example is you take a Burgers equation with a integral term, source term, dispersive term. So maybe it looks like L is a self-adjoint operator acting on UX. So that thing is skew adjoint, it's not damping. And then Burgers is sort of a typical nonlinearity for fluid problems, but you could think about other ones. And, you know, Widom already looked at equations like this in his book and observed you could sort of get arbitrary dispersion relations by choosing, you know, that operator L. Although you have to be careful. I mean, of course, you can't just, how you stick the nonlinearity and the dispersion together makes a lot of difference in the qualitative properties of the equation. So, of course, maybe the classical example of this is KdV. So that basically arises for long wave dispersion. You look at waves as wave number k goes to zero. The frequency basically is omega equals k cubed, and you come up with KdV generically. And then the other limit of waves that are dispersive, as k goes to infinity, then the frequency basically expands like 1 over k, and you get this Ostrovsky equation, which essentially has a lower order integral operator in the dispersion. And you can do other things like combine the two of them, get KdV, Ostrovsky, and so on, add Kp type stuff, so on and so forth. Now, one of the main points about these equations is if you have a lower order term, it can't stop the wave breaking that comes from the Burgers steepening. And so you get sort of wave breaking effects that then combine with this lower order dispersion, and they can be quite subtle. So Fornberg and Widom already did some numerics on equations like this. I wanted to mention an interesting paper by Schefter and Rosales. They did a careful study of this kind of equation where you have basically convolution with a sine kernel on the right-hand side. Got all kinds of very intricate phenomena, chaotic behavior, long-time quasi-periodic solutions. And, you know, one of the things that happens is shocks form and then dispersion eats away at the shocks. So you have this possibility of, you know, for conservation laws, we expect shocks cause everything to decay. And naively, you might think if you add dispersion, that's not going to change that. But the dispersion can eat away at the shocks that cause the decay. And so the behavior is pretty subtle. And I'm not sure how much analysis is really known about those problems. All right, and lots of other people, including people here. So I just wanted this is not really my main topic, but I wanted to mention one equation just because it's kind of cute, that actually a student of mine did in a thesis, and there's some work by, in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, Rybak and others related. So this is the x squared plus 1 acting on Burgers is equal to ux. So the difference is this isn't minus dx squared plus 1, this is plus dx squared plus 1. And so this arises in resonant media where you have sound waves interacting with some oscillations. An example is sound propagation through bubbly fluids where you have bubbles with a certain resonant frequency. And, yeah. Oh, the first, this one. All right, so, yeah, so of course it's not quite written in this form, but if you invert that operator, and then you get something like that. All right, and then one thing about this equation, you can do long wave and short wave limits on this equation. In the long wave, you get KdV. So, for example, Van Wingarden did a lot of work on KdV equations in bubbly fluids. And in the short wave limits, you get back Ostrovsky. Of course, you have to be a little careful inverting this equation because the operator, unlike minus dx squared plus 1, dx squared plus 1 isn't invertible, but you can do a generalized inverse, project onto the range in the kernel. And so you get some equation like that. And if you're looking at 2 pi periodic solutions, then I guess, you know, this p is just projecting onto the orthogonal to the kernel of this operator. You can look at traveling waves and all the various things. I just wanted to mention there's one sort of nice thing about this equation is it actually has a compactly supported pulse solution. This is the explicit solution. So it's just a wave that sort of goes through in the bubbly fluid thing. It's a wave, sound wave, compresses the bubbles, and then they expand again, and it's just a localized wave. It also, since you have the long wave KdV approximation, it also has KdV-type solitons. So here's just one numerical solution. So this is one of these compactly, this is this pulse, just a compactly supported pulse that sits there in the reference frame with this. This is this KdV soliton that's crossing the pulse. And so here's a little movie of the interaction. Here's the KdV soliton hitting this pulse. Passes through it. It actually looks sort of fairly elastic, the collision. But I don't think this equation is integrable, so I just want to make one comment about that. So, and I'm not sure how much these kind of things people have thought about either elsewhere, but say you take this equation, we'd like to know, you know, what sort of integral operators could you put here and maybe get integrability? So one natural approach would be, well, we have the sort of standard flat Hamiltonian structure with the dx operator and this Hamiltonian. So a natural thing to do, like you would do with Burgers, is look for a sort of Lie Poisson type structure for the other one. But now it gets perturbed by this lower order skew symmetric linear operator. Now, I really think this bi-Hamiltonian approach is a really nice approach to a lot of the integrability. Of course, you soon learn if you try and do it that if you don't have the Jacobi identity, if this isn't a genuine structure, you don't get anything at all. So the issue is, does this J satisfy Jacobi identity? And if it does, is it compatible with the first one? Well, it turns out if you just look at the, you know, if you just look at what operators here, this will satisfy Jacobi, you find the only ones are the KdV equations. So you get a sort of, you get a functional equation for the symbol, and basically the only thing that satisfies that functional equation is KdV. So this is a bit disappointing in terms of trying to find other integrable equations with these integral terms, at least with this kind of nonlinearity. And obviously there's various ways you could generalize that, but cubic nonlinearities or systems and so on and so forth. Anyway, at least within this class, it just seems like KdV is the only... Well, of course, this doesn't prove it's not integral. Maybe there's some other structure around, but this would be the natural way to try and find integrability, I would say. So at any rate, I certainly don't know of any integrable equations of this form other than KdV. All right, I just mentioned briefly, since they're coming up, I'm not going to talk about this, but of course... These were linear lower order terms. You can also think about nonlinear terms and get things like the Gasparis-Prusecki or Kamasa-Holm. And there's too much done about those. I'm not even going to try and put any references up, but that's not my topic. All right, so what I actually want to talk about is as we'll see, it relates to what I just discussed, but I want to talk more generally about constant frequency waves. So by a constant frequency wave, I mean a wave whose, in some sense, the unperturbed dispersion relation is just the frequency is constant. So that may seem kind of dull, but I think it's actually pretty interesting. So the idea is the wave motion in some unperturbed limit just looks like a bunch of independent oscillators with the same frequency at different points in space. All right? And then maybe they get coupled together by some nonlinearity or something like that. So the sort of model of this is at each point in space, you just, at the linear level, you just have simple harmonic oscillators which are oscillating away, let's say, at frequency 1. And then this will become relevant soon, but if this is sort of a two-mode solution, omega is plus or minus 1, if you only have a single mode, then the dispersion relation is omega is sine of k, because k for real waves, you know, omega has to be an odd function of k. So rather than put the plus 1 and minus 1 together, you put the plus signum k and the minus signum k together. And in terms of sort of the symmetries underlying this, you'll always get this if the system's invariant under spatial reflections, but if it's not invariant under reflections, and I'll describe an example, then you'll get this one for a single mode. All right, now what makes these kind of interesting, unusual? Well, these waves are not dispersive. The frequency is constant, so the linear group velocity is just zero. Okay, that's just saying because they're just oscillating away independently, there's no propagation of energy by the waves. So they're not like dispersive waves, but on the other hand, they're not like the characteristic hyperbolic waves that you think of, which are non-dispersive, where omega is just C0k. And I'll come to that in a second. But the point is, for these waves, what are the, if you look at weak nonlinearity, what are the dominant resonant interactions? Well, there aren't any three-wave interactions, because omega 0 plus omega 0 is not omega 0. So the dominant interactions are these four-wave interactions. And you get them between a whole spatial range of wave numbers. So basically the K1, K2, K3, K4 can be completely arbitrary, and the frequencies add up. Although one interesting thing to note is, you know, for Burgers, we're familiar with starting with a sine wave and this wave steepens. That won't happen for these because you need actually two spatial harmonics to get this cascade started. If you just have one, you just have k plus k equals k plus k. All right, so this is just to explain that these aren't like, I mean, these are non-dispersive in a, like the hyperbolic waves, but they don't have the characteristic quadratic three-wave resonances. They have four-wave qubit resonances instead. All right, now let me just look at some very simple, three very simple model equations for these types of waves. So, like I said, at the linear level, you just have harmonic oscillators. So let's imagine, just put in some nonlinear spatial terms. So one way that arises is you can put in just two advective terms here. This is what you get, so I call this pressureless 1D rotating shallow water because you're basically putting in advection with a fluid velocity u in the x direction. All right? Now, if you look at this system, actually it's trivial to solve, obviously, because if you go into characteristic coordinates, then it's just back to the linear harmonic oscillator. So this describes waves that are basically doing simple harmonic oscillations in Lagrangian coordinates. Now, here's a slightly different equation. Say, instead, we couple two Burgers equations by lower order terms. So these equations are actually derived in a context of gas dynamics by Maida, Rosales, and Schoenbeck. So here, these behave quite differently. You can't just go into characteristic coordinates and get rid of them. So these sort of look like, so they have pretty interesting behavior. And that's the kind of thing somewhat related to what Schefter and Rosales, I mean, so there's a lot of people did some work on these equations, but starting from Maida, Rosales, and Schoenbeck. But, and let me mention one thing. I'll go through this pretty quickly, but so now, what about the weakly nonlinear asymptotics for waves like that? Well, at the linear level, they just look like, you know, things that oscillate in time with some arbitrary spatial dependence, right? Because these waves, basically, they're oscillating in time. You can make the spatial profile completely arbitrary, and it just oscillates back and forth. So it's kind of interesting if you then do the weakly nonlinear asymptotics for that equation. the complex amplitude turns out to satisfy this quasi-linear Schrodinger equation, which I sort of think of as a dispersive analog of the porous medium equation. Or if you want a physical interpretation, it's like a quantum mechanical particle whose mass gets big when the probability density gets small. So, and there's sort of a general point here, which is whenever you do asymptotics on these equations, like I said, you might think the lower order nonlinearity is easy to deal with, lower order dispersion is easy to deal with, but when you get rid of it, it keeps turning into these higher order dispersive terms. So in that respect, it's actually worse in some ways than using, I mean, the problem is with KdV, the higher order dispersion will control the nonlinearity. With these equations, the lower order dispersion can't do that. And so you get these quite interesting and nasty sort of quasi-linear dispersive equations coming in with higher derivatives. All right, so that was sort of some general background. And then this is the main thing I wanted to talk about here today. So I called this the Burgers-Hilbert equation. So it looks like a Burgers equation with a lower order integral term, this Hilbert transform. Now, why the Hilbert transform? Well, the Hilbert transform just has symbol minus I signum k. So the dispersion relation of this is that positive wave number modes k go with frequency 1, negative wave number modes go with frequency minus 1. So this is sort of a basic example of a constant frequency wave. And I'll explain this in more detail as we go along. But I just want to emphasize the crucial difference from the previous equations I looked at. So I looked before at, you know, some equation with a lower order integral term here. Crucial difference is this is not a dispersive term. It's an oscillatory term, but it's non-dispersive. So it makes a huge difference in the qualitative behavior of the equation at small amplitudes. So Benjamin Ono would have an HUXX. So it has two derivatives on the Hilbert transform. So it's like KdV, it's a higher order dispersive term. Right. So the key thing is this is lower order, so it's more like Ostrovsky, let's say, than KdV. So it turns out, and I may not have time to talk about this, but it turns out this basically describes waves on vorticity discontinuities. So this is how I came to the equation thinking about this vorticity problem. I mean, I've been thinking about constant frequency waves for a while. When I really started thinking about this particular problem, and I'll maybe draw a cartoon in a second, but that's what kind of got me interested in this. So actually, that's just what I said. So actually, it turns out this is an effective equation for surface waves on vorticity discontinuities in 2D incompressible Euler. So think of boundaries of vortex patches, for example. And the only place I've seen it before, it's sort of mentioned in passing by Marsden and Weinstein in a paper also on vortex patches. But they just sort of write it down, do nothing with it. All right, so I guess I have it right here. But this is a picture to give you the physical background, this is not a vortex sheet, it's a vorticity discontinuity. So imagine you have a plane surface here separating two shear flows. This shear flow has vorticity minus alpha plus. This shear flow has vorticity minus alpha minus. So this is not a vortex sheet where the tangential velocity jumps. This is a discontinuity where the vorticity jumps and the velocity is continuous. Now, it turns out, unlike vortex sheets, Kelvin, you have the very strong Kelvin-Helmholtz instability for vortex sheets. These vorticity discontinuities, at least in this idealized form, are linearly stable. And they actually have surface waves that propagate them on them. And these surface waves have constant frequency. And you can see that from dimensional analysis. Basically, the only parameters in this problem are these shear rates, which have dimensions of frequency. So it's kind of like in gas dynamics, the only dimensional constants are wave speeds. So you get omega is C0k. This problem, the only dimensional constants are frequencies. And so you get omega equals omega 0, And it turns out the frequency is just a half of the jump in the vorticity. So, and my claim actually is this Burgers-Hilbert equation turns out actually to provide an equation that describes the evolution of the profile of this equation, let's say just like KdV would for water waves. All right, but that was the particular. Right, so it's a two-dimensional problem, and the assumption is basically that the displacement here is small. You don't quite get slope things coming in because, so the assumption really is so it's not quite a small slope thing because that's what differentiates these problems from the hyperbolic ones, because there is no length scale in the problem, so what do you mean by small slope? All right, so I want to describe a little bit about the Burgers-Hilbert equation and sort of explain what the dynamics looks like, and then say something about the asymptotics, and that'll probably be the end of the talk. But so let me just relate it to the model equations I wrote down before. So if you take this equation, and then you just say let V be Hilbert transform of U, well, if you take the Hilbert transform twice, you get minus the identity, because it's just multiplication by I on the Fourier side. So you take the Hilbert transform of this, you get UT plus Burgers is V, where V is the Hilbert transform. And then the V equation is VT equals, then you pick up a minus U, and now the nonlinearity is Hilbert transform of derivative. So Hilbert transform of derivative, that's, if you like, mod dx, that's the operator with symbol mod k. You just multiply by mod k on the side. So again, this looks like coupled simple harmonic oscillators. And now you have this nonlinearity in here, but unlike the two examples I looked at before, you have non-local nonlinearity coming in here on the V equation. All right, you got rid of the non-locality in the linear term, but you just get it back on the nonlinear term. And I want to comment, these equations really seem to be intrinsically non-local. There's one or two equations, like a famous one is one proposed by Constantine Lax and Mida as a sort of vorticity model, where they involve Hilbert transforms, but you can just transform them to a local equation. There's no linear transformation that will make this local. I mean, so barring some miraculous, you know, linearization through integrability or inverse scattering, which I don't think exists, this somehow you just can't get rid of these non-local effects in these equations. But I just want to, you have to be a little careful thinking about this, and I wanted to explain why. So if you look at the linearized equations, then you do indeed just get back to these simple harmonic oscillators. You have a system where everything is just oscillating at different points of space independently. But there is one slight coupling, namely the velocity is the Hilbert transform of the displacement. So it's not exactly that they're completely independent, because you figure out, you know, you can't just start them with arbitrary amplitudes and arbitrary velocities. You give the initial amplitude, and then the velocity is determined by taking the spatial Hilbert transform. It's a slightly funny thing about this system. And to sort of emphasize that, to show you what it is, let's just solve the linearized equation. UT is Hilbert transform of U with some initial data f of x. And it's easy to see, the solution is just this. It looks like f of x cosine t plus g of x sine t. So what happens is it starts off at some profile f, and then it oscillates to some other profile g, where g is the Hilbert transform of f. So it's not just oscillating up and down, it oscillates sort of from one profile to another profile. And if you look at the Hilbert transform, what sort of happens is if it has a finger in one profile, it develops a steep cusp in the other profile. So that's sort of the linear dynamics then of this system, is it's just oscillating back and forth between two different spatial profiles. So that gives you two regimes for this equation. So one regime is, let's say you have very large slopes, you more or less forget about the Hilbert transform and it basically looks like Burgers. Yeah. Right, you're not supposed, this is Hilbert, you're not supposed to see that because that's the, I played around with different colors and I know the yellow is invisible, but it's actually supposed to be invisible. So. But anyway, this is the large, right, this is the large amplitude regime where it basically looks like burgers, and then the small amplitude regime is it's oscillating up and down, and then you have very weak nonlinearities. Now, what I want to explain is, so in this regime, it looks pretty much like burgers or like Ostrovsky or anything else. Singularity formation time is the typical singularity formation time for burgers, 1 over the initial slope. What happens in this regime is pretty interesting because, see, imagine what's happening. You have this thing, you have this wave flapping up and down, and it's being, okay, the burger steepening comes into play, but what happens is it cancels out because when you have steepening in one phase, it switches direction, you have expansion in the other phase. Or if you like, it's sort of averaging, that the quadratic nonlinearity goes away in this limit and the nonlinearity is effectively cubic. That goes back to what I commented originally, that these constant frequency waves, the dominant resonant nonlinearity is cubic four-wave nonlinearity, not quadratic three-wave. So hopefully this is fairly, this is the initial data. This is a picture for large, just a solution for large initial data. You can see it steepens, it forms shocks, the shocks merge, and you get this kind of thing coming out. And then this shock sort of slowly dies away. That's exactly what you see when you do a Ostrovsky equation with shocks. You get these shocks forming, and the dispersion eats away at the shocks, and they kind of get smaller and, you know, they all combine together and get smaller and smaller. So the only thing the Hilbert transform is doing here is that once shocks form, the Hilbert transform of a discontinuity has a logarithmic singularity. And so you see the profile actually becomes infinite derivative at the shocks. But apart from that, the fact that you have a Hilbert transform there rather than something else is not too big a deal. All right, I may be biased, but I really like this picture. So let me explain what this picture is showing you. That this is a plot of the shock formation. So epsilon here is sort of the initial slope. This is a plot of the time for shock formation or wave breaking. So the green line here, this is the 1 over epsilon time you would get from burgers. So it's a log-log plot. And this red line, this is the 1 over epsilon squared line thing you would get from cubic nonlinearity with a slope predicted from the asymptotics. And what you see is that at larger amplitudes, the shock formation time is extremely well predicted by burgers. And then there's this rather rapid transition, and you go to this cubic timescale. And what's happening is the following. You know, the background solution is sort of oscillating up and down. So if at some, if you know, before it has a chance to oscillate once, the shock forms, it basically looks like burgers. But you can imagine if it's weaker and the shock formation time is larger, then the thing goes through a whole oscillation before a shock has a chance to occur, and then you get this canceling effect that I mentioned. And so it sort of keeps trying to shock up and then doesn't quite shock up, and so you get this enormously delayed shock formation time. Yeah?
Also, when that transition occurs, you prepare the initial condition so that the shock is almost ready before.
Sure. So this was done, to be explicit, this was done with a particular just initial data consisting of two Fourier modes, and then we just dialed the amplitude up and down. Of course, yeah, if you change the initial data so that locally it was very steep or something, then that would be another story. So what I want to do now is explain a little bit about the asymptotics in this regime, the weakly nonlinear regime, where you're looking at sort of small nonlinear perturbations of these constant frequency oscillations. So let me just rewrite the linearized solution in a different way than what I did before. Namely, the solution ut is h of u. So you can write the general solution in this complex form, an arbitrary complex function of x, this complex amplitude psi of x, e to the minus it, plus plus the complex conjugate. Now, the only wrinkle here is it's only the positive wave number modes that go with frequency 1. The negative wave number modes go with frequency minus 1. So the restriction on this psi is that its Fourier transform is purely supported on positive wave numbers. And then the psi star is supported on negative wave numbers. So one way to write that is that P psi is equal to psi. P here, you can see this is the explicit expression in terms of the Hilbert transform, but P is just the projection from all Fourier components onto positive Fourier components. So if you are a positive component, you get 1 plus I times minus I, which is 1, and if you're a negative component, you get 1 minus 1, which is 0. So this P is this non-local projection onto positive negative wave number components. And then it turns out the solution just oscillates between the real and imaginary parts of that psi. That's the F and G I had before. Because if psi has Fourier transform supported in the positive K, then the imaginary part of psi is the Hilbert transform of the real part. So anyway, that's how it works. So, all right, now take the Burgers-Hilbert equation and switch on the nonlinearity and ask how that solution evolves. And so now you have U is some small amplitude guy with complex amplitude psi. You have an arbitrary spatial profile x, and then the whole thing evolves slowly on a cubically nonlinear timescale epsilon squared t. And it turns out you get this equation here for the psi. So n here is mod psi squared. So at least naively, this looks something like that cubically nonlinear Schrodinger equation I wrote down before. All right, so you can see the n is mod psi squared. So this is basically a cubic term in psi. You sort of have one derivative here, another derivative here. But of course, it's horribly non-local, horribly singular, so on. All right, maybe the details of this slide aren't too important, but the Burgers-Hilbert has a standard sort of constant Hamiltonian structure. Here's the Hamiltonian. Of course, the asymptotic equation inherits a Hamiltonian structure from that, so this system is Hamiltonian. Now, I mention that because this is something that's already come up several times in the morning and seems to be really, gaining popularity, namely normal forms and near-identity transformations. So I described to you that the sort of derivation of that equation by asymptotics. You can also derive it by normal form near-identity methods. All right, and what's the idea? Here's the linear system. You then make near-identity transformations to remove the quadratic terms, all of which are non-resonant for this system, and then you just end up with the cubic terms that are resonant. However, because this equation is, as I said, non-dispersive, you have a whole lot of resonant cubic terms. So it's not like, you know, KdV or something where you have to hit exactly the right resonance surface. It's non-resonant, but you still remove the quadratic terms, and then you get a whole bunch of cubic terms. And that's what that previous equation was saying. Now, I mean, here's something where I would really like to get some advice or input, but, I mean, and I think this has been alluded to also a couple of times recently, that it goes back to what I said, that so I've been trying to make rigorous use of these methods, but here's the problem. When you use this near-identity transformation, you're using the lower-order dispersion or lower-order oscillation to get rid of these higher-order nonlinearities. So basically, every time you get rid of a nonlinearity, you pick up an extra derivative. And that's really bad news for trying to show that you can ignore the error terms that also come up when you try and do this. So, for example, I would like to prove that the shock formation time for Burgers-Hilbert with amplitude epsilon data is 1 over epsilon squared. About the best I can do right now is something like epsilon log 1 over epsilon. And I'm convinced it's 1 over epsilon squared, but how to show that, I really don't know. And So if you go back here, oops. You see here, if you start with small data, the shock formation time is of order 1 over epsilon squared. The 1 over epsilon, this would be the standard thing you'd get for Burgers with initial slope epsilon, but it's much longer because of this you know, the fact that the quadratic nonlinearity averages out and it's effectively cubic. So I'd actually like to prove this thing here by proving that the normal form equations really reflect the, you know, the original equation. But right, so let me, so I'll show you very more explicitly in what. So here actually is the explicit near-identity transformation for that system. So you take U as solution of Berger's Hilbert equation. H here is just abbreviation for Hilbert U. Define V to be this. And then here's the equation you come out with. All right. It looks different from the equation I wrote before, but this is actually just the real form of the complex equation I wrote down. All right. And what you can see is just like you had before. So you start with Berger's Hilbert, but now the VT appears to involve second-order derivatives in X. And even worse, you pick up this error term. That error term involves third-order derivatives, or three derivatives in X. And not necessarily third-order, but, you know, the point is, in the original Berger's Hilbert equation, you have a quadratic term with one derivative. The asymptotic equation has a cubic term with two derivatives. And every time you get rid of one of the powers, you pick up other derivatives. So I would like to show that this equation really models the Berger's Hilbert equation, but how do you deal with this singular perturbation that involves higher order derivatives? Yes, please. Yeah, it's absolutely. You are absolutely correct, and I'll show you a commutator form in a second. But yeah.
And then move up one line.
Right.
There are near identity transformations of V, which is a new variable, is U,
you're right,
which is the identity in the old variable, plus the perturbation. And you have to decide, well, is that perturbation small so that we are indeed near identity?
Yeah, so you can invert this. Right. Right. Well, here, so you can show this is invertible once you get to H2. So, yeah, so you're right. You have to worry about the invertibility of the normal form transformation, and you can show that here.
From the same space to the same space.
Yep, H2 to H2. Right. So that, I'll come back to the commutator comment in just a second. But let me just compare this with KDV. I started thinking about this relative to KDV. So say you took KDV with the three derivatives here instead of Hilbert transform. So without worrying about epsilon squared terms, this is the near identity transformation that will get rid of the quadratic terms. And then you get this. And the point is, you see, for KDV, from this perspective, every time you get rid of a power of U, you pick up another inverse derivative. And similarly with the error term here. So it's much easier to control what's going on here than in the other case. So this is partly what I had in mind when I said lower order dispersion in some respects is harder to deal with than higher order dispersion. And I mean, if you think to like semigroup methods where you take out the KDV semigroup and apply it to the nonlinearity, that just fails in these lower order terms. So anyway, that's certainly, there's a huge amount of stuff going back to Walter's work and then Guido Schneider and Gene Wayne, and more recently Masmoudi and co-workers and Wu, and so on and so forth. So I think Chatard was the first one to use this normal form idea in nonlinear PDEs, but it seems to have really picked up steam, I don't know, in the last. I wasn't really aware of it when I started thinking about this problem, but so I don't know if it's just a matter of seeing it everywhere once you start thinking about it, but I don't think it is. I think, you know, it's really something that seems to have taken off. All right, so in the last few minutes, I just want to say a few things about the asymptotic equation. So can prove H2 solutions, for example, short time. The key thing is exactly what Walter said, is that, all right, I went back to the complex form now instead of the real form. But just like Walter said, there's cancellation going on here. Formally, it looks like it's second order, but it's not really second order. And I'm not quite sure what order to say it actually is. It's very slimy to get hold of these sorts of cancellations. But, you know, for example, in the spatial form, it doesn't just have a commutator form, it has a double commutator form. And I don't know what this means, if this is coming from the near identity transformation or where these commutator structures are really coming from. I mean, I just have the equation right there, but I'll explain so exactly what to say. That just, well, this is what Walter said. Must have been peeking at my slide. Now, let me explain. There's another way to look at this spectrally, and that's also very illuminating. So here's the spectral form of that equation. So you can see it's now in the complex form. You can see it's cubic here, and this is in the periodic case. And what this is just a typical interaction equation. It's saying you have the K2, K3, K4 wave numbers interact into the K1 number through the resonant interaction. And here's where the non-dispersive part of the equation is crucial. It's because all these guys are resonant. So all these guys appear. But here's the really remarkable thing. So you have this interaction coefficient lambda that tells you how strongly the K2, K3, K4 modes couple into the K1 mode. So the lambda for this equation looks like this. It's basically the minimum of K1, K2, K3, K4. Now, two things to notice. One, it's symmetric. That's basically the Hamiltonian structure that's dictating the symmetry of that interaction coefficient. I guess it's what physicists call detailed balance or something, but I never quite understood what that meant. So, but anyway, the symmetry is reflecting the Hamiltonian structure. But the key thing you see here is this, and this is sort of on the spectral side what those commutators are on the spatial side. The strength of this interaction is dictated by the smallest wave number that's involved. So that's telling you that high wave numbers can't, if you have a high wave number involved bouncing off a low wave number, it can't have a large component into a given wave number. So this is the thing at the spectral level that sort of stops some cascade of stuff going to high wave numbers, and it's what allows you to get the energy estimates for the short time existence. All right, so even though it seems like you have those two derivatives there, it looks like you have two derivatives. There's a derivative outside here, then this lambda is homogeneous of order 1, so the whole thing is homogeneous of order 2, but in some sense it's not really homogeneous of order 2 because you have this minimum property in here. And this is the thing I have a very hard time getting a hold of. What this is really doing, but so I call this minimal spectral growth condition, and it comes up not just in this equation but others. No, so these are all. So remember, these are all positive wave number modes. So for Burgers-Hilbert, the psi just has the positive wave number modes. So this is always going over all positive. So that's why I write it like this. It's K. So that's why there's the star on the K2, right? And then you pick up the star, this is on the other side. So that's what. So I don't know what this means, but somehow I feel like this is a fundamental thing that's coming out of these equations. All right, so maybe I'll just, to give plenty of time if there's more discussion, I'll maybe conclude here. I want to show you, so, all right, short time existence of smooth solutions is no problem just by standard energy methods because you have these energy, you have the nice energy estimates as a result of this sort of commutator or spectral structure. What I would really love to do in some of these equations is prove some sort of global existence of weak solutions. So here's a numerical picture of, so I'll show you a movie in a second. This is starting with this initial data here. This is the initial data, and it's showing you how it evolves. Now, as I commented, you don't want to start with this just consists of two Fourier modes added together. As I commented, if you start with one Fourier mode, it just sits there, nothing happens. So you have to start with two Fourier modes. And once you start with two Fourier modes, then everything goes off. And this is showing you the formation of singularities in that equation. So it appears the solution remains continuous, and you appear to get these sort of infinitely oscillatory propagating singularities coming out of the equation. So I'll just run that one more time. Now, I don't have time to go into the vorticity, but maybe I'll show you one more numerical thing. But this, I mentioned it in the context of vorticity discontinuities, this singularity formation seems to correspond to the formation of filaments in the vorticity discontinuity. And vortex patches are notorious for that. So let me just show you one more picture. So this is a contour dynamic solution now of a motion of vorticity discontinuity. And it sort of indicates what the Burgers-Hilbert singularities are doing in that. So I can't, again, it's a little, oops, that's the wrong next one. So what's happening is, imagine this vorticity discontinuity at the surface is oscillating up and down with constant frequency. And then there's some spatial pattern which is described by this psi. And that spatial pattern is slowly deforming as a result of this nonlinearity. And the picture is this, that as the discontinuity oscillates, it eventually folds over. And then when it folds over, that fold gets pinched off by these oscillations going up and down. And so you have this repeated formation of filaments that seems to correspond to that infinitely oscillating singularity in the equation. So this is so hopefully this is the right one. Now this is showing you this filament formation in this discontinuity. It folds over, and then it oscillates down, and then it folds over again and oscillates up. And each time it's oscillating, it's pinching off this filament. So the numerics isn't completely refined here, but you can see it just tips over, and then the moment it tips over, the whole profile goes down and stretches out the vortex filament. So it gives you a very nice mechanism, anyway, to understand filament formation in these vorticity discontinuities, vortex patches. Okay, thank you very much. I'll stop there.